Hello and welcome to today's program, the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club, and I'm your host for today. Our program today is Women in Tech, Can Silicon Valley Women Have It All? With Dr. Jalei Dai in conversation with Dr. Moira Gunn. I will introduce Moira, and then Moira will introduce Jalei. We'll turn it over for audience questions at about 12:45. Dr. Moira Gunn is host of Tech Nation and Biotech Nation on NPR and also on Sirius Radio and Armed Forces Network. Moira is also a professor at the University of San Francisco in the School of Management, where she founded and directs the Business of Biotechnology program. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Moira Gunn.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to introduce Dr. Jalei Dai. She is today the managing partner at Aurora Equity, investing in early-stage startups, and also a member of the famous Silicon Valley Band of Angels. Before that, she was at the David and Lucille Packard Foundation as head of science. And before that, I mean, we're talking about when you have careers, a professor at Rutgers and the University of Wisconsin, and Dr. Jalei has got many awards and everything. And so please help me to welcome Dr. Jalei Dai.
Thank you, Kevin and Moira. I want to thank you also, the entire staff at the club, especially Ricky Raffner and George Dobbins. You always do great work, and I appreciate your diligence in what you do. I'm very honored to have the opportunity to talk at the Commonwealth Club. As you may know, I'm on the Board of Governors of the club, and it gives me a great deal of pleasure to talk about a subject that is really near and dear to my heart, and of course, my loyalty to the club and my affection for the club are because this unique institution offers a trusted forum for unbiased and civilized discourse. It's a thrill to actually talk about the subject today because for my entire career, I have lived it. I breathed it, I ate it, I lived it. And I have strongly advocated the issues for advancement of women in science and technology, especially in the last 20 years, once I realized that I have made it, actually, and it was about time for me to help in a significant way other girls and women to succeed in this area. While the published title of the talk suggests a relatively narrow topic, narrow in the sense because it's just one segment of the challenges that women in tech face, and that is how to balance personal and professional life, I do hope to share my thoughts on a broader set of less spoken and more overlooked issues, which are related to the gender gap at the very top, or should we call it gender gulf? It's so big at the very top. The astonishingly low number of women in the venture capital profession, and I see some venture capitalist ladies in the audience. The disappointingly low percentage of funding success for women entrepreneurs. So these are the three core subjects that I would touch on today. And I will go through quickly through some major points, but I do want to leave you with two key messages. The first one is, talking to my sisters here, sister in crime, science and technology, let's commit ourselves to not get discouraged, don't give up, and let's not opt out. I ask you to not make perfect the enemy of the good. And I will talk a little bit about that, expand on that. The other message I would like to leave with you is, in order to close the gender gap at the very top echelon, let's make sure that men share accountability, and we have a few good men in the audience, thank you. Let's ask men of power and influence, to join us and help move the needle. Underrepresentation of women in the boardrooms and as top executives is a perennial subject for discussion. Essentially, it's a pyramid with a very large ratio of base to top. And in this case, imagine a funnel, not a standing funnel, but as an inverted funnel, like a pyramid. This is an inverted funnel that actually the narrowing part happens very abruptly. And as you go up, it becomes very hard to move through the aperture. Quite often the situation is attributed to a thinning pipeline, but the gender gap is in the upper echelon is hardly explained by pipeline issues alone. For example, in life sciences, there are more female graduates than there are men. But where are they? As line managers, as senior executives, in the C-suite, and in the corporate boardrooms. To be sure, female participation does decline progressively throughout the education system and as we go on to higher rungs of the career ladder. Girls give up math and science in school. Teenagers don't want to look too smart, so they give up on working on their math and science courses. College students switch out of science and engineering majors, or women who actually have enviable technology careers opt out. These factors all contribute to the unsatisfactory situation of a leaky pipeline. In fact, I hear top corporate and VC leaders citing the leaky pipeline as the main reason for woefully low number of women at the top. The common thing that I hear is that we'll have them if we can find them. Well, you know, to me, this sounds like an easy answer to a very complex question. That is only a very, at the very top, this is a very minor part of the issue, especially in life sciences, as I mentioned. There are quite a few senior women that could be moved up relatively easily. One overlooked fact and a pinch point along the way is that many qualified women opt out of very good technology positions as a result of conflicting needs and obligations, especially those women who are in their childbearing years, or women who have family members who are ill, and by default, most of the time, women are the caregiver, the default caregivers. So for that reason, they drop out of their positions. And then some women find it rather unpalatable to stay in highly competitive environment. Quite frankly, this is becoming a unisex issue as more men reassess the fullness of their life and the challenges of making choices and setting their priorities. So I think increasingly men are becoming torn between personal and professional choices that they make. Anne-Marie Slaughter, who would be speaking at the club, I guess, in a few days or a week or so, started a flood of discussion about the challenge of balancing career success with a fulfilling home life when in 2012 she wrote an article in The Atlantic entitled, Why Women Can't Still Have It All. She openly talked about her decision to leave a high power position in the U.S. State Department reporting to Hillary Clinton, and by doing so, going back home, and by doing so, it started a timely dialogue about how women and men define fulfillment and success. Women's expectations of life and work has evolved during the last few decades. Baby boomers were the first generation who dared to demand equal opportunity and access to the very top of the career ladder. They knowingly sacrificed aspect of their personal life because they wanted to scale the heights. Today, some women in tech seems to wish to have it all. The truth is that we cannot expect to have it all. If all means spending every waking minute of our child's life with them and simultaneously aspiring to an ambitious career. Well, there are not enough minutes and hours in a day for that level of intensity and perfection. In real life, few things are perfect. Perhaps we can accept that all is what each of us as unique individuals in time and place define it. Perhaps having it all simply means that we get pangs of anxiety when we leave our kids in the morning to go to work, and when we leave the office with a project unfinished, or miss an important business and social networking event in the evening. Perhaps having it all means occasionally second-guessing ourselves about our choices and priorities, but still manage to do what is most fulfilling at any phase of our life. And these could that definition of fulfillment at different times would be different for each one of us. As women in technology, we should see our world to be great without expecting it to be perfect, and accept the human condition of having to deal with imperfection quite often. The truth is that women have the talent and fortitude to stay in the fray and play the game to win. You cannot win, you see, you cannot win unless you are in the game. Not staying in the game means giving up careers that are too exciting, too rewarding, and too significant to the advancement of humanity. I know that technology world best thrives when women are full participants, because best innovations come from diversity of thought, diversity of experience, background, and unique perspective that women bring to the table. As I see it, it's a privilege actually to contribute to innovation through science and technology. I always felt privileged to have a career in this area. We owe it to ourselves and our daughters to actually further smooth the trail and find ways so that they face fewer dilemmas as today's women do. Today, corporations and many public institutions offer a wide range of incentives to minimize attrition of women and men. So we should fully take advantage of these incentives and, in fact, work to improve the system so that the next generation of women would not face the same challenges as the baby boomers did and as we do today. I deeply believe that opting out and leaving the problem for others to fix is not our best option. We can make leaping change by first getting women to lead at the very top, and when powerful men become full partners for effective change. So let's enlist men of power and influence and ask them to be true agents of change. So my friends, my message to you is simple. Please don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. So now, let me talk a little bit for a few minutes about the challenges faced by female entrepreneurs, because they are key to advancing the cause of women in science and technology. These women and entrepreneurs and founders who seek capital for their bright ideas and the companies they're trying to hatch and grow. Recent data indicate that only a tiny fraction, 5%, plus minus one or two here and there, of venture-backed startups have women on their management team and executive teams. Think about this. One half, the other half of the population is getting 90%, 90 to 95% of the share. Now, how lopsided is that? How comfortable are we with this number? How long do we want to see this? This is neither good for our global competitiveness, nor is disenfranchising half of our national talent sustainable. Every game-changing innovation deserves the opportunity to be presented to the investor community. Even if we could get all innovators in front of the right financial institutions, how do we get the funders to write checks? This is a very important question. The people who hold the capital, and here my friends and colleagues in the venture capital, I'm talking to you. The people who hold the capital are the only ones who can turn the situation around. We need to deliberately cast a broader net so that we ensure that the best deals are reviewed and captured. Statistics, in fact, show a strong financial performance by women founders. But a common reason, again, given by investors as to the reason for an anemic representation of females in their portfolio, investment portfolios, is that they don't see enough women founders. Well, you know, it sounds like the other excuse that I mentioned earlier. As is the case with numbers, there is huge imbalance between the number of women who are ready, have good ideas, and have put together a reasonable business plan, are seeking funds, and the actual dollars that is ultimately invested in women-run companies. Huge disconnect. In fairness, we are beginning to see some modest improvement. Female-gated VCs are springing up. These are an angel funds, VC and angel funds. These are women who these funds have been started by women, typically women who used to be working at VC firms, and now they're setting up shop to make sure that they basically fund women-owned and run businesses, support women entrepreneurs. The second encouraging improvement is some corporations are also setting aside modest gender-gated funds. The example that was most recent I saw was that Intel has now about $30 million fund that is totally dedicated to women-run businesses and women founders. These are good signs because money talks. It speaks louder than initiatives, conferences, and a whole bunch of feel-good speeches. While there is not enough time for me to list all the reasons why we continue to have this gender gap or gender gulf, I do want to summarize a few key reasons that are most important to having women at the top, broadly and not really exhaustively. The first one is very much a human nature kind of thing. It's tribal behavior, which is rampant in the Silicon Valley, actually. The male-dominated culture of Silicon Valley, despite being so innovation-driven, remains very tribal. It's at a primal level, we are basically caveman and cavewoman. So you see it manifested even at a place which is driven and obsessed with innovation. And it's really baffling. Why? Why are we so innovative in everything, but we are still so tribal when it comes to addressing this issue of funding women entrepreneurs? One of the funny things is I quite often hear some male colleagues say, well, you know, women need to think a little bit more linearly. And I sort of shake my hand and say, you know, the best ideas come from getting your left side brain and right side brain to interact rather than just think linearly. That's the easy part. The difficult part to think in a more sort of loopy way and come with great new ideas. The other thing that I think is a major factor is organizational behavior. There's an awful lot of unconscious bias and groupthink, which contributes to choosing and surrounding yourself with people who look like you, who think like you, and have very similar point of view. This means that we hold to the archetypical notion of what a leader looks like. We apply different standards of behavior and judgment to men and women. And to just give you an example, a few years ago, without naming names, a female CEO of a major Bay Area corporation was really disparaged in the media for having used a four-letter word. She dropped the F-bomb publicly. And the media made this big hoopla and really thought it was awful. Well, show me a male CEO in the Bay Area who does not do this on a routine basis. I would like to meet that endangered species. One last factor that I want to talk about is women themselves. As Sheryl Sandberg has eloquently described and constantly articulates beautifully, is that women do not lean in time and hard enough. We do not pursue status, power, and position as vigorously, as intently as do men. We wait too long to make a push, which could mean being too late to the dance. For example, in pursuing a higher position, women hesitate until they have checked all the qualification boxes. They feel unprepared unless every last single box is checked. Men don't do that. They don't wait for all the boxes to be checked. They check two or three and they say, yeah, I'm ready. So we need to learn from men in this area. Or when seeking capital from funders, women wait to get one more piece of data, the next milestone, or a stronger proof of concept. So they just keep delaying to go and ask for funding. When they get to that point for asking, they settle for lower valuation, for less favorable terms, even after they have got the interest of the funders to support their companies. They settle for less. So these are just a few points, and I want to close by saying that change won't happen until we place a sense of urgency on the issue and focus on doing instead of talking. Leadership seeps through when it's set by example. A first good step will be to populate the very top with women as corporate board directors, in the C-suite, and in other line and executive positions. With that, I thank you for listening, and I'm looking forward to my discussion with you and with Myra. Thank you.
Thank you. We're tethered. Can't go far. Well, Shelley, that was wonderful. That was wonderful. A lot of food for thought. One of the things that I'm actually reminded, as you say, about women being ready, and you know, the fellas said they check a few boxes and say, I'm ready. I'm actually reminded of the work of Professor Jacques Barnet from the University of Cherbourg in Quebec. And what he found is that when he took females and males, that the girls had a very low confidence rating compared to how competent they were in entrepreneurship. The males had a very high confidence rating compared to their compared to their ability. And that what changed is once the women got some experience, real experience in entrepreneurship, their confidence rose, and it matched what their competency was. You know, so it seems to me that in all of the strategies, and we've been talking about this, strategies in raising confidence to match the reality of what you're really capable of, that we have to do some work here to how do we get women ready so they can start to move forward. What, give us some ideas about that.
Well, it just, as I said, women approach things differently and consequently. When they do go for a raise, for a promotion within their organization, or to go raise money for their company, they have a more realistic view of the world and themselves. Sometimes it has to do with lower confidence and lack of confidence. But even confident women, if you take a woman who is confident, successful, has made it so far, everything she's done, we tend to have a more realistic view of ourselves, our limitations, our strengths, our weaknesses. Whereas when I talk with men, and having been the first woman in this, first woman in that, I have been in a totally male-dominated environment most of my career. What I see is men have an inflated view of themselves and their abilities and the fact that I'm going to conquer the world and you are not going to stand in my way, which is healthy when you are moving a big idea, which is so novel that people say, are you crazy? This is not going to work, you know, in entrepreneurship. The first time I remember Band of Angel, most of the Band of Angel members, I'm one of those, I wasn't part of it, but before I was a member, most of them rejected Google when the deal came to them. Only a few of them just said, okay, I'll put some money on it. So when the first idea is proposed, almost everybody says, are you crazy? This is not going to work. And men, the way they take it is, you don't get it. You don't understand it.
Oh,
I'm
going to
change the world.
You don't
listen
understand.
To me. Yeah. But women sort of recoil and say, maybe he is right. Maybe they have a point. I better go do a little bit more proof of concept. So it's that kind of a thing. I think we have a more realistic view of ourselves as opposed to men who haven't. Most men, I shouldn't have said all men or all women. So please, when I make generalizations, it's for the purpose of the conversation. It's not to say all men or all women.
But we do have research which shows that this is true, unfortunately.
Yeah, in large majority.
So, that's science, you know?
Yeah.
So here's the reality. You're saying, okay, great. I mean, this is a difficult challenge. It's like, women have, you yourself, all of the females, you have a very realistic view of yourself and your capabilities and what's going on. And then the people next to you who are vying for the same venture capital funds have an unrealistic one. How do you compete with that? Because you're saying we got to increase the female participation.
You watch them and you learn. I remember when I was a graduate student, the first major seminar I went to, a man was speaking, one of the faculty members, who was pretty, you know, nationally and internationally recognized. And here I am, this little PhD student, and I go to his talk, and he gives this fantastic talk about this subject that I knew a little bit about. So I sat there with total admiration and saying to myself, I want to be like him when I grow up. So that's what we need to do. We need to learn. At the Band of Angels, for example, or any VC can tell you, when men come and pitch and when women come and pitch, it's very different. So women come and pitch. They do a great job at pitching. And so hands go up to ask questions, and you always shoot it down, right? Whether you're a VC team or angel team, you just shoot it down. That's the norm. So you bring to shoot at them, start to shoot at them. Why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you doing that? What about this? What about that? And so women tend to say, well, yeah, what do you think? You know, what should I do? You think I should do this or that? They ask questions, ask for guidance. Men would never do that. Not never, but
what are the, now we're all dying. What do the men say? This is a learning opportunity.
Men say, oh, we have a great team. We have really, we are on it. We are on top of it 24/7. We've got some great VC who's talking with us already. You know, it just, they come up with an
answer. You're lucky we're talking to you. Yeah.
And there are VCs in the audience, probably. Does that sound familiar? Anyway, and I'm generalizing. I'm exaggerating a little bit to make the conversation a bit more lively, to draw you and come up so you can ask questions. But it's this sort of...
Well, you know, what occurs to me, I mean, part of the problem here is changing the name of the game. I mean, like, just changing the game. I, too, you know, while you came out of science, I came out of engineering. I was the first woman to get a PhD in mechanical engineering from Purdue. And that's a huge engineering school. And I'm telling people, the floodgates have opened. You know, women are here. Get ready. And then the next woman to get a PhD in mechanical engineering with Purdue was 17 years later. It's like, oh. But today the dean of engineering is a female. And what is starting to change in engineering, as an example, which applies directly to Silicon Valley here, is that they found with the females that they could do something naturally, which all the CEOs that were hiring the male engineers were saying, boy, I wish these guys could work in teams, wish these guys could communicate. And now part of core undergraduate education in engineering is working in teams. And the girls get A's. In fact, we were all walking by the Neil Armstrong lab there in engineering, and we looked in at all the undergraduates and teams, and there was one team that I loved. There were three, they were all in fours, the three good-looking gals and this one nerdy-looking guy. And I thought, this guy is peaking. It's never going to get better than this. But they were like, we got some great skills here. And so, but what's happened is the art and science of engineering has begun to recognize those things that women are good at. So you can't do that until you get a certain threshold. So when you're saying get more women funded, get more entrepreneurs in there, it may be we may see a sea change in the culture.
Well, you know, it's really interesting. The motivations are different for women and men. I can't remember the source of this piece of information that I'm going to relate to you, but that was a few years ago. Somebody at some university did a study at an engineering school, and they sort of did a double-blind kind of thing, asking groups of male and female to design a robotic arm. In one case, they gave them the task of making a robotic arm for a tank, for a soldier who is in a tank and needs to reach outside and do something. In the other case, they asked for a robotic arm of a very elderly man who had difficulty opening the tuna can for his dog. So it turned out that the women came up with beautiful design when it was for that man who was trying to feed his dog. But they didn't excel as much to design a robotic arm for a tank. You know, so the motivations are different. So to me, that was the most fascinating. I wish I could remember who did the study so we can go look at it and maybe do more of those studies. But I think the motivations are different.
I think that's really borne out. The dean of engineering that I was referring to is Leah Jameson. And when she was a young assistant professor, she said, we've got to get more women in here. And she created a community-based thing where she would send freshman girls out into the community to do different technology projects that helped families and individuals and older people and all of that. And so what she was able to do is, like, when they were happy to learn all the engineering if they could help people. Yeah. So what we're coming now is we're coming in a way where Silicon Valley and the great biocluster that we're in and all of that is coming out of a male legacy. And it's not that it's going to go away. What we have to do is somehow integrate that. And part of that, as you well point out, is that we need more women at the C level, at the executive level.
And in the boardrooms, too.
In the boardrooms.
Because the culture seeps from the top to... Water seeps from top to the bottom, right? So it penetrates...
Equal F-bombs for everybody. Oh, no. That would be wrong.
That would be wrong. I think in this area, men need to learn from us. Don't use the F-bomb so much, you know.
I'll remember that. So, I mean, I think that all of these things are very connected. And I've been thinking a lot. We had a great conversation. You should have really just listened to our conversation talking to coming in here, because we've known each other for years, but talking about coming here. And, you know, what are the unique pressures on Silicon Valley women? And I include the biocluster here, because it's both technology, life sciences, information technology, all of that's coming together here. We have an amazing opportunity. It's not over with yet. This area is booming as an intellectual leadership place. I mean, this is like, don't leave now. This would be the wrong time. Mm-hmm. And I kept thinking, what are the unique pressures on Silicon Valley women in that? And part of it is the game is tech. The game is science. The game is everything. You can't just go there without credentials. How important in your mind, because you see a lot of aspiring entrepreneurs and women entrepreneurs, how important is it to get credentials, to get education?
Well, as a former professor, I am not going to say don't get an education, obviously. but there's always, I mean, I'm one of those people who try to be not dogmatic about any one thing that you should or should not do. I was, a few nights ago, I was fortunate to meet Elizabeth Holmes. She gave a talk at the Commonwealth Club, and I was there. And as you know, she is the founder of Theranos. With a pinprick, you get few drops of blood, and you can do on demand any blood test. So that's what her company does. She dropped out of Stanford at the age of 19 to start this company. So obviously she did not finish. She was in the College of Engineering, bioengineering. She was a life science bio kind of engineer.
She had both science and engineering.
Right. So she dropped out and created this company. The company is a unicorn 10 times. The valuation is $10 billion. She has some of the most distinguished people on her board, including former Secretary George Shultz and former Secretary Bill Perry. You can't get any better people than that. So obviously it works. It worked for her. She didn't get a degree. But most often, I would say, please get your degree. Don't opt out, you know, because I am an educator.
Elizabeth was great, because I remember I got a very early interview with her before we actually knew Theranos was going to become anything. And I just kept saying, what are you going to do when you're 30? You know, kind of, what do you got planned for 35? You know, but she had, because she was at Stanford in this particular area, and because there were VCs here and professors here and management here, and she had a network around her saying, she's really got something. And so what was connected with that, she was already an entrepreneur. She already could see it. And so there was a reason to leave.
Yeah.
She had that. Most of us, you know, it's like, so it was the right things coalesced together. I have a young student right now who, I think you just cured cancer. I mean, it was like, and it's like, okay, we have to get the right people around you to act on this idea. And it's like, and don't waste your time getting a PhD just yet. Go. Google Boys, same thing.
You know, and she said during that talk, Sal Khan, who started the Khan Academy, interviewed her. And somebody in the audience asked, when was the last time you went to vacation, or where was the place you went to vacation? I don't exactly remember, but it had to do with her vacation time. And she said very adorably, she said, "I don't go on vacation. I love my work. I think it's just great to work." And she said, "I even live in a house that doesn't have furniture." So it brought home to me this point about making choices. At any time and moment in your life, forget about having it all. Just make choices and priorities and do what is the most fulfilling to you. The Harvard Business Review just had an article out in the most recent issue that the title is "Forget About Getting It All, Make Choices About Women and in the Workforce." So I think when you look at somebody as successful as Elizabeth Holmes, she would tell you that she's happily not going on vacation. I didn't go on vacation for the first 20 years of my career, and I never complained. I didn't want to go on vacations because I went all over the world, gave talks, and so I saw the world anyway. I didn't need to go to some beach in Italy to feel like that I'm on vacation. So I think going back to the issue of having it all, we need to make choices and set priorities and just do what is the most fulfilling to us.
Well, with that, I was thinking a lot about, you know, if you're a Silicon Valley woman, you've got to make choices. So I thought I better make a list. You can, like, check yes or no. You know, it's like, okay, everybody in the audience, raise your hand. His and her Teslas? Okay, so that's not on the list. You know, it's like we have some pretty crazy choices that we can make. Yeah. And I think that one of the things that I think is extremely important is that our template for careers has been a male template.
Right.
And actually, we came through at the time feminism had its first sort of big blossom, you know, with the baby boomers, and we were just like, yes, we can do absolutely everything the same, and which I actually understood to be, I totally believed until the day I got pregnant, and the next day it's like, okay, it's your turn to do this. Whoop. Yeah. I'm still pregnant. I'm the one who's pregnant. And it's like I wanted to integrate having my choices were to have children with a career, but I had made my choice was I'm going to get my PhD before I have any children. And so these are the kinds of choices that you strategically make that are years old. It's like, what do you want to do? You want to do it now, later?
You're a baby boomer, mm-hmm. if I had to guess. I'm a baby boomer. I remember when I was a young, budding professional assistant professor up for tenure, I knew that if I'm pregnant and I go to the lab or in front of a lecture room, I will never be taken, or give a talk at a symposium, I will not be taken seriously, because most people would think as soon as she's going to have a baby, she's going to go home and take care of the baby. So my generation, our generation, you and I, a majority of us, not all, you got your children, but a majority of us decided not to have children. So count yourself lucky this generation, because Marissa Meyer is going to go to work every day until she's probably with her twins in her tummy, until she's probably a week or two before she gives birth. So count yourself lucky that you can go to work, do serious, substantive work, and still have your children. So we have come a long ways, baby, but we still have a long ways
to go. But your career is longer than raising children, you know, unless you really screw up raising children and they refuse to leave. It's like you must raise them to leave. This is very important.
Now you can freeze your eggs and have them when you're 80. Have children when you're 80 years old.
Now I want to make sure people start asking questions, so please make your way to the microphone here, and we have a question.
Well, thank you. No, I just have an announcement right now. I'd like to remind our audience listening at home, this is the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club, your host for today. Our program today is Women in Tech. Can Silicon Valley Women Have It All? With Dr. Zerlei Dai in conversation with Dr. Moira Gunn. We are going to now turn it over to our audience members for some questions. If you'd like to come up to the microphone, please. And in the meantime, Zerlei, if I had a question. So as a man who works in San Francisco and Silicon Valley, what can I do to help make things change for the better?
Oh, very good question. My husband never asked that. I had to tell him, you got to hire women. No, he's good. He's okay. He's right there. Embarrass him. He actually was a dean, and he hired quite a few women faculty under the influence. So to your question, I think what of the easier things you can do? There are lots of hard things that men can do. But one of the easier thing you can do, when somebody says a disparaging thing about a behavior of a woman, which is the same as a male behavior, but he does not get disparaging remarks, just remind them, would you say the same thing about a male colleague? That, I think, would help us with our unconscious biases. We don't mean harm. We are not mean people. It's just the culture, the unconscious biases. Just remind them of that gently. Thank you.
Moira, do you have a comment on that, too? And if anyone else has a question, if you'd like to come up to the microphone, please.
Sure. Before I start calling on you, you see, we're professors. We'll call on you. I think that we have to understand about unconscious bias, and I think a lot of people know about this from Malcolm Gladwell's reporting of the thematic apperception test at Yale, which tested do you have unconscious bias, because most people say, we'd have women if we could find them, as an example, and they don't understand their unconscious bias. He took the test, and he said, I found that I did not respect black males with financial advice. And he goes, my father's black. It's like, how could I do that? These are unconscious ones that not only other people have about women, but that we women have about any number of things. If you're human, you have unconscious bias. And so one can't see it. And the example of if we could see it, I was relating a story to Jalay on the phone about how I was voted onto a particular board. And when that happens is when you're voted onto board, and all the women in this room will be voted onto boards if they have not yet been, I have every confidence, is that you stand outside while the board votes and then you come on in. And as I was coming in, the head of a publicly traded, very large, recognizable firm whose software is on all of your computers was sitting there, and he was having a conversation with one of the few women on the board who was saying, we need more women on your board, at your publicly traded company. And he said, well, if I could find someone who had the background, whatever. And this person, not only did I do my research in this area, I worked for him when I was at NASA for a short time. He invited me over to come and see a pre-work. I totally existed, but I couldn't be seen. This is the nature of unconscious bias. And this may be part of your, I just need to do more, I need to do more. And it's like, you could do more till you were blue in the face. You can't be seen. So this is part of, I think, the cultural change. It's like not to try to change the unconscious bias, but to make it conscious and change the game. When you change the game, you're in.
Megan.
Hi. I just wanted to follow up on a few of these pieces that we've been talking about. For the organization I work for, it's BP Ventures. We have a portfolio of about 25 companies. One woman CEO, all right? One female in the venture capital team, that's me. Oh, I'm sorry. Is this
so
better?
So that's the 5% we were talking about?
Exactly. And so to follow that up, I used to say you either believe in the diversity argument or not. You either believe that people from different backgrounds and genders and races and experiences offer something unique, or you don't. You buy into it or not. And as you alluded to, though, we don't just have to say that anymore. There's real evidence and research going on now that companies with diverse boards do better. And, some countries have been trying to make changes, saying, I have a goal. We want 30% women on boards or this kind of diversity at our board levels. And so I'm going to go back kind of to the gentleman's first question. We all know this now. We know this.
Yes.
What do we do about it? Because the only good answer I have is what you told Roger. Hire women. Put women on your boards. But there's an invisibility factor. So I wondered if you all wanted to expand just a little bit on that. Is what can everyone walk out of the room today doing that can start to initiate real change if you believe in that diversity argument that it has an impact?
Most of the people that I see in room are people who are in careers. Some of you are in very high power careers as I look in unfamiliar faces. I think you need to practice this every day. And I deeply believe that we need to get men of power and influence into this process as full partners. It's not enough to have women groups, women this, women that. We need to sit down and talk to the big guys. And I think when somebody like Sheryl Sandberg, who is big in her own right, plays in the big sandbox, when she leans in and talks about this subject, men listen. And so you see all kinds of male CEOs are beginning to talk about it, beginning to, you know, Intel having this gender-gated fund for women entrepreneurs. So the more we talk about it in a positive way, we don't have to do male bashing. What we need to do is enlist the men to work with us. So every opportunity, every turn that we have, we should ask for men to help. I was recruited to a board. That board has never had a woman. Never, ever. I was going to be the first woman. So the chairman was very keen on recruiting me. Several lunches and this and that. So at the end I said, I would love to join your board with all these powerful men sitting on your board. But I would ask for one thing. I would come on the board if you promise me that by the 8 years that was my term would end, we would have 3 women on that board, which was about 25%, 30%. So each and every one of us, men, women, girls, boys, we can demand these things in the nicest way. I knew he wanted me on that board. So I figured, okay, I can't ask him for a little bigger office or this and that. So I leveraged the negotiation point was, can you promise me that there would be more women on the board in a few years? And he did, and he delivered, actually. So that's what we can do. Positively ask, actively ask.
I'm very struck by, you mentioned it, that women opt out of highly competitive environments. It's a highly competitive male-structured environments is what this is. And I have to say that when you opt out or you decline a higher position, you have to understand that when you have authority, when you have power, when you have a position, you can change the culture. I'd like to anecdotally talk about there are 7 departments in the School of Management that the faculty are divided into, and one is led by a woman. And it was, really, one is led by a woman. And it is amazing because their meetings are unlike everybody else's meetings. And it was like quite the talk when it started. Everyone starts out and they all check in with each other and they all help each other and they do all these things that women do together. And there are more women in that department than there are in any of the other departments. I'm the only woman in my department, for example. And it's changed because she is the department chair. If she said, well, I don't know, then I have to go to those department chair meetings, and then everybody's going to be yelling at each other, and it's going to be this, and there's going to be all this. And finally, it's like, it seems highly competitive, but you cannot personally affect change unless you step up to the plate. So to set a switch, you can make the change if you grab it.
I think there's a question out there. Yeah.
Hi, thank you. A study came out recently, McKinsey Lean In, a few days ago, that talked about the possibility of gender parity. And it's not something that I haven't heard before. I've been working with women in business for a few decades. It came to the conclusion that it's going to take 100 years. 100 years to reach gender parity. And I've watched women sit in audiences and listen to those kinds of statistics. and feel very discouraged by them. They throw their hands up and they say, why are we even trying? We're not going to achieve gender parity in my lifetime. And even the young women listening to it feel discouraged by it. It becomes a meme that begins to influence their aspirations and their ambitions. What can we do to ameliorate the impact of studies like that and encourage women to be more forthright in their enthusiasm and aspirations to step into visible and influential leadership?
You know, I saw that same article, and I did read it, although not the whole report, just the bits of it that was in the media. That 100 years was on the assumption that if we go at the same rate we have been going in the last 5-10 years or currently. So I'm a scientist. I am optimist. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm optimistic. So my hope and total belief is that the rate is going to accelerate. So we are going to shave off that 100 numbers by accelerated rate of change. But that could make it another 20, 30 years. And that is too long for this young woman who is sitting in the audience to wait for her. By the time she's 40, 50 years, we are going to be parity. No, you can't do that. So that means the rate needs to accelerate tremendously. And I'm total agreement with Sheryl Sandberg. We need to lean in into women, into men, into corporations, into the society. We need to lean in. We don't have to be hostile. We don't need to do men bashing, male bashing. We just need to speak with facts, with passion, with commitment and conviction, and just ask. And you shall receive, right?
I think one of the things we don't know is here's that 50-50 thing. So girls and boys, male men, females, should be 50-50. It's like we don't know what the right percentage is. You know, people say to me there should be more people in engineering or more women in engineering. Well, engineering is the art, you know, is very left-brained. I mean, you literally have to do the math. And you have to do specific kinds of math, rather analytic. Now, there are women very good in analytics. There are many things that come together, but you say, well, what percentage of the population could become surgeons if we give them absolutely every opportunity and everything? It's like, what is the right percentage? We are, men and women are different, in case you never figured that out before. And it's like, all of this. So I don't know at the end of the day what is 30% right? Is 20% right? Is becoming an entrepreneur later in life after your children have gotten into high school and college and now you really have a burst of energy, you've got all your experience, many kinds of experience, and now you're going to become an entrepreneur. This might be the way to look at it. You know, let's look at it in terms of ages of your life and what you're capable of doing. And so I don't think going in, I'm not sure, and so when I hear the gender parity, I want to say gender parity and opportunity, absolutely, everyone gets it, but when do we have it? What is the right thing for people? I think we need to really ask some deeper questions of ourselves and see what's there to see what will happen.
Yeah, the article was emphasizing, because it was McKinsey collaboration with leanin.org, which is Sheryl Sandberg's founded organization, they focus on parity. But I think Moira has a good point. You can never, you know, try to reach parity because people are different. That's why my entire career, when I go and talk and try to promote an advocate for girls and women in science and technology, I always talk about equity, not parity, because who am I to say what parity is? So in numbers, quantitatively speaking, yeah, it's 50-50, maybe 51% women. But qualitative, we should focus more on the qualitative nature of this issue, which is, am I going to thrive the best as a scientist or as a mom at home? So it's about equity, not parity. There is another question.
Hello. Hi. My name is Kimberly. I'm a staff person here. My question is about perhaps the discrepancy between the types of projects that are funded between men and women. I've read somewhere that a lot of women entrepreneurs, they come with a business idea that is very, has a social impact or a humanistic impact, sort of to your point about that, the robotic arm, whereas men come with, you know, these big ideas of making lots of money or other goals. And do you see, does there need to be a sea change in terms of how we think about what types of projects are funded by VCs?
I mean, obviously, you are on to something in the sense that most of the entrepreneurs we see with ideas and business plan in hand asking for capital, more women have social-based kind of companies because that's what their motivation comes from. And a lot of the hard tech kind of things are founded by male, right? That's the current status, you're right. There is disparity, large disparity, what you see. But increasingly, you're seeing women like Elizabeth Holmes that is turning the entire blood analysis and the insurance system and the healthcare system for blood lab analysis, she's turning it on its head simply because she had this passion and idea and went out and did it. So I hope that things would change. But like I said, we, after 2.5 million years of evolution, we are still caveman and cavewoman. So that is a primal thing in us. The motivation is a primal sort of in our DNA. Another question is out there.
Oh, but actually, let me just add on a little to that. You know, 15 years ago, you would not have in a proposal to a VC anything about sustainability. And now we know you'd better have that in there simply because you will be challenged once it becomes a reality. And if you can use that to either show more profit, show social concern, show something like that. So the idea of when those goals change for some of the social responsibility, and let me give a really quick example. When Gilead Biosciences, they did the first combination single pill for an antiretroviral, which is extremely important in sub-Saharan Africa with a huge HIV/AIDS problem. People were both illiterate and poor, and it has been a huge, huge problem. And when they first came out with it, they said, if your country is on the UN emerging countries list, developing countries list, you will get that drug at cost before they had any ROI, before any return on investment. Now, if you're a rich country, you got to pay. You know, but so this is a change that we would not have seen before. So we can start to deal with economic models that show compassion and show that women could be very good in affecting that. There are no laws of economics are not like laws of nature. Laws of economics are human-made. So I think that the idea is to get enough women in there and to understand some of our, change our goals, and then the women will be very good at helping how might we form that to still have high profitability. And it wouldn't have changed the name of the game anyway if they were going after that. They clearly were there. Yeah.
Jenna.
Thank you, Dr. Gunn. I'd like to remind our audience listening at home, this is the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program today has been Women in Tech. Can Silicon Valley Women Have It All? With Dr. Jalee Dai in conversation with Dr. Moira Gunn from Tech Nation. Unfortunately, we've reached that point in our program where we have time for only one more question. I am going to turn it back to an audience member for that final question. And then, Dr. Dai, if you'd like to give us a closing comment, and then we'll adjourn our program today.
Great, thanks. This is a great conversation, and I actually found the part of the conversation about how women, when they're pitching to VCs, react to criticism. I found that fascinating. So I just wanted to get your take on how much that impacts women in the greater business world, if that's a contributing factor in your mind to maybe why we haven't gotten as far along the track as we want to with parity, or whether that's just really something that the whole business world needs to change and maybe not criticize women as much. So just curious how you see that as a factor in
where we are. It's very important. It's very important what you ask for and how you ask for. I learned that probably early on as a child. I grew up among nine, and so I had to negotiate my way, right? So I learned to negotiate, and my father was very easy to negotiate with. So I gained confidence to ask, and if he came back with lesser, I would say, how about this? And so when I got into my career, I learned very quickly that if I don't ask in a nice way with facts behind it and why I'm asking for this, I would never get anything. So I think women need to very deliberately and intently, especially you younger women, you need to intently learn to ask for what you want and what you're good at and where you want to be. Not today, but 5-10 years from now. If you want to be in a line position, in an executive position, you need to ask for the right things. One woman I was talking with recently, she said, well, I chose the path that does not have a lot of travel. So I said, honey, this is not going to get you a senior executive position. It's always going to be a staff position. So she never realized that if she takes a path that requires, in a global economy, you can't have a path with low travel and expect to get to the top. So very important what to ask, how to ask, when to ask.
And I totally agree with that. And I'd also like to add, having, you know, sat with my friends who would see a very well-recognized VC finally got in front of them. We're talking mid-level funding, already proven. We need the next, you know, tranche to come in and negotiating these things. And I remember her saying to me, I knew he wasn't going to give it to me. I knew it, and yet he had me fly to the East Coast, talk to him, do this kind of stuff. And he goes, she's like, I just can't get over, I think it has to do with the fact I'm a female. And just, she was so, so devastated. And I mean, this things happen like this to men as well. But so, and I think that let us not underestimate changing the game. That's getting the money from the people who currently have it in the way they're going to give it to you, and you're duking it out with the guys. There is nothing more positive, nothing sharper than just changing the game somehow. I don't know what that solution is. That's going to come out of you and me and Jalay and everyone else. It's like, how do you change the game so they're left in the dust? That is another alternative that I think whenever you run into these blocks, always say to yourself, do I have a different trick that could change this? And that has huge repercussions.
Well, Kevin asked me to make a closing comment. Thank you for that, Kevin. I'm going to repeat what I just said at the beginning, what I said at the end, and I'm going to say it again. So let's commit ourselves not to get discouraged, give up or opt out. I ask you not to make perfect the enemy of the good. And the second thing I would like to repeat is, in order to close the gender gap at the very top echelon, let's make sure men share accountability for the issue and ask men of power and influence to walk with us and help us move the needle at a faster rate. Thank you.
I'd like to thank our audience listening at home and our audience here today at the Commonwealth Club for being here. Our program today has been Women in Tech, Can Silicon Valley Women Have It All? With Dr. Jalay Dai in conversation with Dr. Moira Gunn from NPR's Tech Nation. And with that, I would like to adjourn this program of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened public discussion. Our program is adjourned.